Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Oh, this young man is a sensation! Dele Alli, out of League One, into the Premier League! Oh, what a goal! It's Danny Rose on his Premier League debut!
Sheringham Fleck and Klinsmann is in!
He's got it lost under his feet and it's come from the middle!
Welcome back to another edition of the Internet's most dangerous Tottenham Hotspur podcast. It's Wheeler Dealer Radio. I'm your host, Greg, and I am here to talk about two games that gave me an existential crisis as I sat there with my child in his Tottenham onesie and wondering how early you can be sent to jail for parental abuse, because I think I might have just really done him wrong, because why would anyone subject their child to that? But yes, we are here
to
talk.
Did you think you had a window where you could abuse your child and it was okay? Let's get this out of the table.
Brian's the lawyer.
There's a grace period. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, Brian, thank you.
You've got 90 days, and then after that, no.
You got 90 days.
Money back guarantee.
90 days while you can be a Tottenham fan and no one's going to judge you for it. It was too early.
I'm going to recheck the flight logs and see about some of my podcast hosts.
It was two really rough games. We had a, 3-1 loss against Sheffield United and a stirring 1-0 victory against Everton. But I am joined by our regulars today to have a very uplifting conversation about these two games. We've got Ben Daniels. Ben, would you say these games were a life-affirming experience for you?
Yes, they definitely affirmed my decision before the Premier League resumed that this is a terrible idea, and I stand by that.
We are also joined by our official legal counsel of Wheeler Dealer Radio. We have Brian Ashlock. Brian, how much legal trouble am I in for forcing my newborn child to watch these games?
Well, as we just discussed, obviously, none, because you have a 90-day grace period.
Great.
Look, the laws are different in certain states, but definitely in Florida, you have at least 90 days. I'm not sure about New York, check with your other attorneys. But yeah, 90 days in Florida, totally fine.
Brian, I think we left the Manchester, not the Manchester, I think we, okay. Brian, I think we left the West Ham game on this podcast actually feeling relatively upbeat about Tottenham Hotspur. We thought this was not, you know, the most exciting performance in the world, but it was positive. You could see a lot of things working. Ndombele didn't start, but whatever. Like, there was still, like, you know, there was a successful attacking Tottenham squad that you could see sort of in the works. And I think we all, even Ben, left this podcast, like, relatively upbeat. And I think these last two games just did a lot to undermine it. What happened? What was the change?
Well, if you'd ask Jose Mourinho, it's the mentality of the players. And, you know, it is our loser's mentality that is letting us down. His boys are trying to win a fair play trophy rather than an actual trophy, neither of which we're ever actually going to win. The Sheffield United result is worse, obviously, because of what the scoreline ultimately was and the way in which those goals were scored. We've talked about on this show before, you know, sometimes it's better to win than to win pretty. And, you know, with Jose Mourinho, we signed up for that, basically. Like, we're just going to get a bunch of ugly 2-1s and an ugly 1-0s. So Everton is kind of like proof positive that the plan is working, but the Sheffield United result is, especially when you consider that that team is competing with us directly for Europa League spots, for not necessarily Champions League spaces, but they're in and around that same position. That's a really damning result.
Well, and I think what's particularly damning about that result is, and Ben, I'm interested in your opinions about this because I don't know if this is overstated. It certainly felt like we were the better team for 40 minutes the first half, certainly up until Kane's goal got disallowed. Sheffield United's goal felt like very much of an aberration. And, you know, I thought we played pretty well in that first half. You could start to see, like, the semblance of, like, an attack that made a lot of sense. And, you know, I thought it was actually, you know, it was kind of what I think we all wanted to see against Sheffield United. And then it just, you know, I don't know if Sheffield figured something out. I don't know if it was a mentality thing, because certainly getting that goal disallowed, we did not respond well to it. But, I mean, Ben, was it as... am I overstating because the initial performance, because the rest of that game was so dire?
I think maybe a little bit, but I think we were definitely, if not the better side, at least very much in it for the first half. You know, they scored, and then we equalized immediately, and it was like, okay, you know what, well, I'll take a reset. You know, we still look positioned to, like, get something out of this. And, you know, I mean, first of all, we should talk about how fucking asinine that disallowed goal was, because the handball rule doesn't make any sense. But it did seem like, you know, Jose Mourinho isn't entirely wrong that there's a mentality issue, because we did just not respond to that adversity well at all. I mean, you know, a good team would say, okay, you know what, we put one away, we're playing well, we can keep going, and then we just didn't. You know, I don't think we were great in the first half, but we certainly looked like we were attacking and, like, had some ideas. I think it really all fell apart when we took off Bergwijn early in the second half for Eric Lamela, who, you know, I have a lot of time for, but he wasn't very good, to put it mildly. And Bergwijn was, I thought, comfortably our best player in that period where we were actually putting stuff together. And once he was gone, we just seemed to lose all ability to knit the attack together and take the ball and transition. And I just, besides fitness, I have no idea what could possibly justify that decision.
I mean,
like, he didn't seem like any more cooked than anybody else.
He had surgery over the break. So it's like, if you want to tell me, if Mourinho came out in the press conference and said, I don't want to fucking break him with all these games, I, like, of all the things Mourinho's done, that is by far, I think, the least objectionable, is protect Bergwijn.
I mean, great. He didn't say that during the press conference.
No, he
didn't.
But I think we can assume.
Everton, so.
I think we can assume with how much he's using him that there's, you know. But
I mean,
let's talk about that penalty for a second, or the VAR review, because, like, that was ridiculous. What really bothers me about VAR, which is, like, if you're gonna, like, cue that close to the rules for, like, that was handball, like, so we're gonna disallow the goal. The fact that you are not going to also look at that and say, well, Moore is clearly getting the shit fouled out of him, so if we're not going to, like, give you that goal, we're going to give you a free kick from that position. Like, it just... I'm sure every podcast about any English team or Premier League games is going to talk about VAR constantly, but... And God knows we've gotten our yucks out of VAR decisions over the years, but... At the same time, it's like, they're so ridiculously nitpicky. I mean, you know, Son is always, like, a toe off sides, and they'll call it. But they're so ridiculously nitpicky about some things. And then, like, you know, it's like, Moore is getting knifed by three Sheffield players, and we're just going to ignore that. But, you know, the ball grazes the outside of his hand in a motion that he clearly has no control over. Like, he's not trying to handball. There's no intent there. And it's not like, you know, it's not like it waxes pollen or something, but, you know, we're going to call one of these things, but not even pay attention to the other. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, VAR is a huge problem, obviously, but one of its biggest failings is that it puts certain rules under a microscope that they were never meant to be looked at under. You know, the handball rule has always allowed for a lot of referee discretion to be like, yeah, it's a handball, but it's not really a handball, so, like, let's move on with our lives. And this forces you to say... to treat it like a binary situation where it's like, if it touched the hand in any capacity, no matter how mundane or inadvertent it may be, we're going to call it. It just exposes how terribly written the rule is. And at the same time, it's not allowing the opportunity to revisit any number of other rules. You know, and like this example where he played an advantage on Lucas's foul. And normally you play an advantage and the advantage doesn't pan out. You pull it back to the spot of the advantage and you call the free kick. But somehow, in the machinations of pulling it back because of VAR, we've lost the opportunity to pull it back to the free kick. And it's just like, why? Who made that decision? And why is that so wildly inconsistent? And why does that make any sense?
Well, I think one of the things that, not that this makes it better, but one of the things that the match officials admitted after the game was that they should have pulled it back and given the free kick. That, you know, the advantage had obviously ended then when Lucas handles the ball, and that there should have been a free kick to Tottenham at the point where Lucas is fouled, that the match official just handled it wrong at that time. So you know, that's something that, you know, that's on the league, that's on the Premier League officials. You know, the officials need to know that that's the rule. Like, if you play advantage, then subsequently during the playing of an advantage, you know, something happens to end that advantage, that you pull it back. Like, it seems like a basic thing. But it wasn't applied here. I'd honestly forgotten that this whole incident happened.
A tribute to the rest of the game.
Yeah, we're just going to talk about how these three goals were trash. And then I was like, oh, yeah. And I mean, and that wasn't even like, that was obviously the big VAR decision in that game because it gets a goal chalk off. But then there's another questionable VAR decision, you know, what, probably like 5-10 minutes later, where the Sheffield United midfielder, whose name escapes me right now, eyed up Son and then elbowed him in the head.
Yes.
And didn't get a yellow card for it.
And why? Because it's his second yellow. We don't want to send him off for a second. He fucking elbowed a guy in the head.
It should have been a straight red.
Yeah, it should have been a straight red. But because he didn't, like, haul off and break Son's nose, because it wasn't, like, as vicious as it could have been and, like, incapacitated Son, it's like, oh, don't want to give him a second yellow for that. But so there's two calls that could have changed the game.
Right, and they both seem to be made with completely different standards of review, standards of intent, standards of clear and obvious error. Like, I can see no consistency between one and the other in how we arrive at those decisions.
Well, and it's the problem with VAR, which is, like, if you're going to call it to the level of which that's a handball, like, if you're going to be that meticulous about it, and then you're going to let other shit ride, it's like, come on. Like, you know, either you're going to let some stuff ride.
Honestly, look, I'm sorry. We've already talked too much about VAR.
But yeah.
The fact is, like, that game was a fucking shit show from Spurs. Like, VAR, you can say it was a mistake and we should have been at 1-1 going into the half, but
they still fucked it up. You're absolutely right.
It's just unacceptable from everybody involved, from the players, from the coach, from the substitutions. I mean, once again, you know, we have 5 subs.
He was about to make a double sub. He was about to make a double sub that might have made a difference, and then they scored that second goal, and
right. And
the game feels like it's over at that point, like, which it shouldn't have. Like, there was still like 30 minutes left at that point or some shit.
I mean, it was the 70th minute when they got the second goal.
And again, you have 20 minutes left. A team like Spurs should be able to score two goals in 20 minutes against Sheffield United. Or at least it shouldn't be, like, completely unreasonable that that's, like, a thing that might happen, you know?
But the whole game in and of itself was really, like, ugly. Like, for a game that had 4 goals in it, like, I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, Spurs have 8 shots, Sheffield United has 7, majority of possession. And to me, that is the biggest problem with the match from Spurs' perspective. You've got 64% of the ball, and we just didn't look like we had any ideas on what to do with it, how to create space, how to create attacking chances. You watch on the limited opportunities that Sheffield United break into our their attacking third, our defensive third, and they've got very practiced movements in terms of what they're going to do. That center back overlaps, and he cuts it back to the attacker who's at the 12-yard, the penalty spot. And it's just like, you know, you can see that this is something that is drilled into that team by their manager. And look, I understand that Jose Mourinho has only been in charge for so long or whatever, but, like, he also had, like, a long break and, you know, all this kind of build-up to Project Restart. And he just didn't. And so to watch us kind of shunt the ball out to the right and have, like, Aurier cross it in and, you know, have it either cleared away or have it hit the first man, there was just no ideas. And it's just something, like, I feel like we've been talking about that for Tottenham Hotspur for years. It's not even just a Mauricio Pochettino problem. It was an AVB problem. It was a Tim Sherwood problem. It's now a Mourinho problem. And it's just like we don't know how to unpick, you know, set defenses. And it didn't matter for Eriksen. It didn't matter for Lo Celso. We just don't have ideas for what to do there. And it was really evident against Sheffield.
I mean, I think that's really overstating it. We definitely had periods under Pochettino where we played very silky football and we could pass our way through a box, and Christian Eriksen and Dele Alli were playing cute dink balls over the top, and we were playing good cutbacks and interchanges. Like, that's not not been there for Spurs. It's definitely not been there for a minute.
I'd say certainly since last January. Yeah, certainly since like things fell apart last year.
But you're right. I mean, the contrast. I mean, the Sheffield United, especially their last two goals, the moves that they made, passing through and inside of our box, with defenders present, was frankly humiliating. And you know, like one of those goals, I think I saw an image on Twitter where they have, I think, eight guys in our box to our like five, and it's just, I can't imagine a scenario on the other end of the pitch where that's something Spurs are doing. They have that many people camped out in their box for like a passing move that's just like pinging the ball around defenders to find those holes.
Which
and
is...
they just cut us open with ease. And you know, our defense had been like, you know, we'd had a lot of good things to say about that Davinson-Dyer pairing. You know, even our fullbacks were showing up. Our defensive midfield was doing its job. But I mean, I have no idea what happened between the first two games and that game, because we looked like we'd never done this before. And I don't understand.
But that's like how this whole team looks. I mean, we saw it today against Everton, which, like, you know, I don't want to discount Sheffield or Everton's defense, because I think you shouldn't. But, you know, we get the ball up there, and it's almost like you could see Lo Celso makes, like, some amazing pass. Or even Kane. Kane did it a few times today. And, like, they'll make a pass. We'll get in their final third. We'll dilly-dally on the ball long enough for them to get men back. And then we just sort of pass it around. I mean, it's like, it's literally like watching AVB again. It's like, where it's just like, we don't know what to do. And we're talking about an attacking band that at various times has Bergwijn, who we know is a dynamic attacker who can make things happen, Son, Harry Kane, who at least, has some ability to make things happen. And, you know, even a guy like Lucas Moura, who I know we shit on a lot here and deservedly so, but like, Ben, I was talking to you during the game about like, for all the dumb shit Lucas Moura does, he is still capable of doing really impressive things on the ball and capable of having really good games. Even just without any direction, I feel like these guys should be able to put together a more coherent attack than we've seen. And it's been ages since we've seen all Spurs attack that looked like it knew what it was fucking doing.
It's frustrating. Lucas Moura especially. I hate that guy. Obviously, we've all talked about what an annoying piece of shit he is. But like, he does have a skill set, and it is carrying the ball and dribbling and doing amazing things with the ball at his feet. And for whatever reason now, this has been, 2 years of two different managers seeing him and thinking, oh, he should be the guy making runs into the box and not the guy who should be just dribbling down the wing. And I just will never understand it. It's literally the only thing he's good at. You see him get on the ball periodically today and, you know, break down the right flank and like link up with Serge Aurier really well. Like, they interchange pretty well as like a pairing when they get into those positions together. But most of the time, like, he is not doing that. He's not being asked to do that. Maybe he doesn't want to do that. But like, I think a clip went around the internet after the Sheffield United game where like Lamella is driving forward with the ball and he has Harry Kane to his right and they're breaking into the box together. And Lucas comes charging in and runs directly at Lamella. Lamella has to check back on the ball and like loses his opportunity to break into the box. And then Lucas, instead of peeling away into somewhere useful, then gets in between him and the ball to Harry Kane, who is unmarked inside the box, and the pass just deflects off of him and it goes and goes to a turnover. And it's just like, none of this has anything to do with what he's good at, and it's all he's being asked to do. No. And it's just maddening.
Maybe this is a little bit like I'm being a bit of a football Luddite here, but like, I don't understand why he's not just like, why Spurs coaches look at him and think, you're Aaron Lennon, but we're letting you shoot a little bit more. Like you can cut in, you're allowed to cut in a little bit more and take shots, but otherwise you're playing like Aaron Lennon, you're going to hug the touchline, and like maybe occasionally we'll let you do something else, but basically stay on the right flank. Like,
well, and I think you guys are absolutely right, and that's a correct identification of what his skill set is, but Lucas has, since his time at PSG, been very adamant that he feels most comfortable playing centrally, like, as a second striker. And so, like, I think the issue is not with how managers want to utilize him, but, like, what he feels his skill set is personally.
Lucas isn't Gareth fucking Bale. Like, come on, like, fucking do what you're told. Like, you know.
But see, I think he sees himself as a creative 10.
But like, that's the thing. Why are coaches still playing him if he literally can't take direction?
Yeah, exactly. He's not.
He's not taking direction, or we're giving him bad directions. Either way, it's a problem. And
we're giving him no direction, which is entirely possible.
But Lucas is not an institution at the club. He is not like the most talented player on the pitch at any given time. Why is he allowed to do this?
And especially, it's frustrating when you see today. You know, we were turgid. I think is the only word I can think of. The first half was just one of the most abysmal slogs of football.
That was the second half. The first half was slightly less abysmal than that.
I was going to say, until I saw the second half, but you stepped all over me.
Well, you know. Now you know how it feels.
Way to ruin a good joke, Craig.
It wasn't a good joke. It's fine. But no, but one of the biggest problems was, you know, we had Lo Celso playing a number 10 role, which in theory is good. You know, we've missed an Eriksson-esque player for years, including the years we had Eriksson. You know, having that added creativity in and around the box is, we've been crying out for that. And when we got the ball there, he was good at it. But we struggled so hard to get him the ball in dangerous areas. There were points when Harry Kane was dropping back in between Lo Celso and Winks to, like, make the transition for him to get the ball from, like, the defensive phase to our attacking phase. This is a problem that is tailor-made for Lucas to solve. Like, you get the ball to him around the halfway line and just let him carry the ball. He can beat a man or two. He can run in space. And he can move the chains. He can move the ball downfield and allow us to transition to the attacking third, which our midfield was incapable of doing today. And again, it was just a job not allowed of him, not being asked of him, and instead he just sucked.
Well, and so you see, even a game like, I think this Everton game, and we're jumping around now, but I think all these games, to an extent, you can say this, is like, Spurs have these like players on the pitch of varying ability, and the problem is it's like there's no sort of like coherent strategy to utilize them all. It's like Lo Celso is doing amazing things on the ball and transitioning to attack, and no one seems ready to like Lo Celso will get these incredible balls played, and like people just don't know what to fucking do when they get in the final third with them. There was a play today, because I think a player has not come under a lot of criticism, who I think actually a lot of Spurs fans were giving Lloris a bunch of shit today for yelling at Son. And like, I don't know. I don't think Son has been that good since he's come back. And, you know, there was a play. I know that Lloris was mad at Son because he wasn't defending from the front, and he thinks that led to that shot that was taken right before the half. But what drove me insane was there was a 1-2 that Son and Harry played in the box, and it was almost like watching a game of FIFA or something. And I couldn't believe that Son didn't at least get a shot off because he was in central, and he just sort of stood on the ball for a little too long. No one looks like they're in sync with anyone else, and Son is just as guilty as anybody else.
Well, yeah, I'll say this. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say, look, it's really weird to me personally that this is a team that has been together for so long, and we've talked about all the things that are detrimental about keeping the same core group of players. But one of the things that you wouldn't think is that this group of players wouldn't all be on the same page with each other. You know, how long have Harry and Son played together? How long has, you know, Lamella and Lucas played together? You know, how long have Sissoko and Winks been in the same midfield? Like, you wouldn't think team cohesion and understanding of each other's movements would be a weakness. But it is, and we continue to see the same problems and same issues that we saw under Pochettino with, you know, arguably what's supposed to be a markedly different system under Mourinho, but what's basically playing out to be the same sort of football and the same sort of results. Like,
I guess I will say in Sonny's defense, we had two shots on target today and they both came from him. You know,
but how many Lo Celso passes went to Son to die today? Like,
right. But I think those hustle passes went to a lot of people to die today. The only time they didn't die, I think, was through Sonny, which doesn't mean that he wasn't letting them die also. He just... he was the only guy making runs that were stretching the defense and trying to get in behind.
Yeah, and he made that one really good run that I don't remember. I think it was... Was it Toby who pinged the ball all the way up there for him? And Son sort of created a shot out of nothing. So it's not like he didn't do anything.
And you would expect Harry Kane to be like there was a perfect opportunity for Kane to crash the box. Pickford did a terrible.
It was if anybody had been following up that shot, it's a goal. Like and
again, Harry Kane is just dragging behind play in a position where a year ago, 2 years ago, whenever Harry Kane was fit again, like you would have bet your house on him being right there to crash the box and follow that up. And no one was there.
And I'll tell you
what. It's funny because.
Go ahead, Brian.
What I was just going to say was, with respect to Kane's performance against Everton, it's funny because he was actually very much at the races against Sheffield.
Yeah. He was mad against Sheffield about the rest of his team. Like I thought he was very irritated in that game.
And, you know, you saw the people on Twitter putting, you know that he had a hat trick of goals, you know, chalked off by VAR or referee decision, which wasn't really true. But, you know, like... he was very much getting into scoring positions, getting into and shooting, actually getting shots off in that game. Whereas against Everton, it looked like the Harry Kane we saw against Manchester United, where the movement was lacking, where he was coming deeper to get the ball. And like Ben said, he was helping with transitions and stuff, but he then wasn't getting back up the field to get into goal scoring positions. And so it makes you wonder, like, are we in a spot now where Harry Kane is good for... you know, 90 minutes a week, and that's what we've got. And then when we're having him play 270 minutes this week, how many good matches of football are we going to get out?
And this is where I take it all back to Jose Mourinho, because of course I'm going to take it back to Jose Mourinho. But you have a guy like Kane who's coming off of injury, and, you know, you talk about, well, Bergwijn has to be managed for his fitness because of his, you know, surgery over the break. Like, Harry Kane is going to play – we had a game on Thursday, we had a game on Sunday. Harry Kane is going to play 90 minutes in both of those games, even though he already looks like he's on his last legs. Like, you know, the most dangerous we looked was when Son was occupying those striker positions. You know, we know Lucas, for all we've just talked about, is not his best position. He can do a job as striker. We do have options to rotate around that, to give Harry Kane a breather every now and again so that, you know, we can kind of maximize his usefulness and instead – we've just run him out for 90 minutes four times in a row, and half the time he's looked good and half the time he's looked shitty. So, I don't know. I hope he looks good on Sunday against Arsenal and looks shitty against Bournemouth. I mean, what? Like, that's the best case that I could hope for, is that he just picks the derby to be the game that he's up for. It's just maddening. You know, we have a deep enough squad that we can rotate, that we can make these decisions. If people are fit. And if it's not a fitness issue and Harry Kane's just inconsistent and bad, then that needs to be dealt with on its own terms.
I'll tell you what is most frustrating to me about watching the game, and it really, about watching this team, and it really clicked for me against Everton today, is like, I think for really since, you know, Moussa Dembele just stopped being the player that we remember Moussa Dembele, so I don't know, a year and a half now, this team has just been crying out for a midfielder that can set the tempo in midfield, that can dictate the game. And we finally fucking have one. Like, I mean, Lo Celso, I think, for the last two games, has just done some just unreal shit. I mean, just some, like, Luka Modric-level pass. Like, I think he's made some passes that are just, like, better than Eriksen used to be able to do. And I know they're being asked to do different things. And part of what impresses me so much about Lo Celso is and it shouldn't, because at Betis he was really used this way in the attacking band, but... I mean, he's a real Swiss Army knife of a midfielder, where he can just do so many different things. We finally, and I really did think about this team, and this is predates Mourinho, but I really thought, like, fuck, just get somebody in there who can knit that midfield together. And goddamn, we'll be cooking. Like, because really, there's this just giant hole in the middle of a pretty alright Spurs team. And we finally fucking have it, and it's the only thing that's working, and it's not really working because no one seems to know how to play with him. And I don't get it, because it's not like, you know, occasionally he'll, like, land a pass on someone that they didn't think they were going to get. But, like, really, he's, like, putting these guys in really decent attacking positions. And they're like, I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to do with this ball now. And then the whole – and before they can figure it out, the whole defense manages to get their asses back. And, you know, we're back to square one. But, you know, so I have been incredibly impressed by Lo Celso over the last, like, two – ever since this quarantine – or since the quarantine break ended, I think he's been incredible. I think he's better than I thought he was going to be. And some of the shit he does is just completely unreal. I don't know how he pulls off some of that passing. And just that we are unable to capitalize on it drives me out of my fucking mind. I mean, he's so good.
Well,
I mean, I think a lot of it comes back to, you know, that we still don't necessarily have a fully functional midfield. I mean,
you're right.
Lo Celso is doing a lot of stuff to help make us tick, and he is doing a lot of the defensive work that we would have liked for Harry Winks to have been doing all these years. And he is doing a lot of the passing that we thought Harry Winks could do. But then we're still also playing Harry Winks. Moussa Sissoko for, you know, I don't want to say improvement, but for the very defined tactical role that he has under Jose Mourinho, you know, he's still not the midfield destroyer, you know, ball winner that we really want. And, you know, we've talked about this on this show. Every other Spurs podcast in existence has talked about this, but we have another star midfield player on this team. We have Tanguy Ndombele, and we continue to refuse to play it.
Who can put in a defensive shift? Like, that's the annoying thing about it. Like,
I mean, look, he came on against Sheffield, and he played, what, 25, 30 minutes, and he was good.
Well, that game was a shit show by the time he came on.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, look, he comes on, he tries stuff. Like,
it's better than Sissoko.
I love watching him play. I mean, he's got a ton of sauce. Like, every pass he plays, he looks really weird playing every pass because his body shape is really weird, and he plays them all. Like,
He did have, not to lean too hard into some unfortunate stereotypes, he did a bunch of stepovers at one point, and it really did look like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man was doing stepovers on the pitch. It was not as graceful as I think he meant it to be.
Doesn't have to be, because you never see it coming from a big man.
Right. See, but, like, you know, the Everton game, next week against, or not next week, like, in 2 days against Bournemouth, like, these are games, like, he should be playing. And it shouldn't be cameos off the bench. And, you know, like...
But I would settle for a fucking cameo off the
bench.
Yes! Like, again, we've seen him one out of four games. Like, come on.
Like, get somebody on there, and it could be, you know, this Southampton guy we're going for in the offseason. Get somebody in there to fucking help Lo Celso out and let this guy cook, because he's so fucking good. And what infuriates me is between Pochettino checking the fuck out and hiring Jose Mourinho, I'm terrified Lo Celso's big contribution to Spurs is we're going to make a lot of money off of him in like a year or two, and that'll contribute maybe to the next good Spurs team. I mean, that's how fucking negative I'm getting about that. And I'm probably the least, well, Brian's probably the least negative person on this podcast, but, like, you know, Ben's on this podcast.
Isn't that a weird turnaround?
Yeah, but it's just frustrating. Like, I know we're wasting Ndombele, but Ndombele really hasn't done much for Spurs. We're wasting Lo Celso, and he's, like, on the pitch doing incredible things. And what it's infuriating that these very good players don't seem to know how to take advantage of these excellent things Lo Celso is doing.
I mean, first of all, Ndombele, when he was playing at the beginning of the season, even sporadically, we all saw his sauce. He was making magic.
I'm not saying Ndombele is not.
Goals from deep midfield. Like, he was playing very well.
I'm not saying he doesn't have something to offer. What I'm saying is he has played slightly
more minutes. I'm saying he's already offered it. We've already seen, like,
I'm saying he's played slightly more minutes for Tottenham than all of us have combined, whereas Lo Celso has played several games, gotten used to playing with these players, and they still can't fucking use his passes.
No, you're right. And I think, you know, you can squint and look at this team and be like, okay, we bring in Højbjerg, and we get a midfield of those three guys, and then Bergwijn, Sonny, and Kane, and, like, boy, that's an attack. And, you know, as long as the defense is pretty good, like, we should be able to do some shit. But, again, I don't feel confident in any of that ever happening, so what am I hoping for?
Well, and part of it would rely on, like, we have a normal summer where guys can get acclimated and, like, you know, not that we trust him to do this, but Mourinho could implement whatever his tactics or strategy is. But we're not even going to have a normal summer where, you know, God knows what kind of training they're going to be able to do this summer. So it's like, you know, I don't, like, I'm sort of getting past the point where I'm, you know, maybe it's not fair to Jose Mourinho. Maybe it's not fair that, like, the situation's so fucked up and he can't get his shit in. But the point is, we need someone who can do that. And if he can't, then it's time to get someone who fucking can.
So one of the things Ben just mentioned was, you know, if that's our, you know, front six sort of, and we can figure out a competent back line, we can be good. And we kind of saw two different contrasts in the back line. You know, we saw the Sheffield United back line this week, which was basically what we'd rolled out the first few games of the break, or, well, the post-break football matches, and it looked really bad. I'm curious to know what you guys think, because I couldn't have picked one person out of all four of them that was specifically the problem. I thought Dyer and Sanchez were both not particularly good. I thought Aurier was the same in terms of what we see from his defensive. Like, you know, his offense wasn't particularly good in this match because his crossing I thought was pretty bad. But his defense was about what I expect from Serge Aurier, which is maybe giving him a pass. But, you know, and Davis I didn't think was particularly good against Sheffield. And then you see the Everton match, and the only casualty in defense is Sanchez, who gets dropped for Alderweireld. Which I know I personally had questions about why Toby wasn't playing. And then we got a clean sheet against Everton, and Everton really didn't have anything in the way of chances. So is Toby back good for us, or
I think there's a couple things between the two games that you can point to. One is Everton, I think, were just particularly bad today. It didn't necessarily have a ton to do with us. You know, their midfield of Andre Gomez and Tom Davis is as much of a sieve as Harry Winks and Moussa Sissoko are. You know, they just let us have the ball for huge stretches of the game, and you know, even though we couldn't do anything with it because it was just a bunch of sterile possession or you know, incoherent attacking moves that broke down, they were never able to take the ball from us and turn that into attacks. And they also decided for some reason to, like, really not press us, which has always been a huge vulnerability of this team, and they just declined to do it. So we were never turning over the ball in dangerous areas for the most part. So we were putting the impetus on Everton to, like, really build attacks from scratch. And, you know, their attack, Gylfi Sigurdsson is a shell of himself. Iwobi hasn't really put it together. Calvert-Lewin's been a good striker. Richarlison's been a good striker. But again, when those are the only two guys in a six-man offense, it just doesn't have a lot of ideas and doesn't have a lot of, you know, room for good creative attacks that are going to spread us apart.
Well, but I'd say... Well, just a quick butt in, and I apologize. It's like Sheffield United doesn't have anybody that scares you in that attack. You know, their leading goal scorer has, what, 6, 8?
They don't. They don't have good strikers. That's the thing about Sheffield United is, like, they have somehow cobbled together a top-half Champions League-chasing performance out of, like, 8 guys who scored, like, 4 goals apiece. And that's insane, and so many bad teams have at least one striker who'll get you 10-12 goals, and Sheffield can't even imagine that. They've rolled out like 7 different strikers this season, because none of them are actually dangerous in and of their own right. But they are dangerous in the way that they have a very unique attacking structure with wing backs and overlapping center backs, and they make weird overloads in areas of the pitch that are very atypical for how most teams in the Premier League play. And that's something that any team should have seen Sheffield United do by now and primed themselves on how to defend against it. You know, what do you do when a outside center back comes charging into the backfield and a central midfielder makes an overlapping run the other direction and there's the wing back cutting in from the other side and now you've got 3 guys in an area where you only have one person defending it? You know, you should be able to be ready for that. It is not... It's unique, but it's not, like, overly complicated that a good manager can't say, this is how you beat them. I mean, they got their asses smoked by Man U just a couple days before. Aston Villa kept them shut out. Like, this is not a particularly tough team to contain, but it is a unique team to contain. And I think that was the problem mostly for us, is Serge Aurier and Ben Davis were very much pulled out of position by their attacking wingbacks, and in the gaps between them and the center backs, you had Chris Basham and I can't remember if it was Robinson or I think Robinson was on the other side, just waltzing forward out of the back line, and nobody knew who to track because they had their attention, you know, Sissoko and Lo Celso had their attention focused on the midfielders, and so these guys would come in and then they'd have to change marking positions to go shift over to them, and then, oh, Sander Burgess free in the box and just sweeping it home. And those kind of handoff and mismatches are, again, not hard to solve, but we just didn't seem to have any awareness of what was going to happen. and it baffled us every time. And they managed to overload us in places that we shouldn't be overloaded in constantly. That's my philosophy, at least, on what happened. But it was,
well, and then on the second, I think it was a second goal, it just looked like everybody forgot what the offside rule was. Where, you know, the ball got to the end line, basically, and then I think Dyer, I think, let whoever the striker was there, McBurnie, I think, get just beyond him, like a yard or two of space between the two of them, and then he was there to put home an easy cross. And it's just like, you know, it was the kind of stuff you saw, like, early Pochettino, like, when he was trying to rid us of, like, the Spursiness or whatever. Like, that is what that performance looked like. It was just individual errors and what Pochettino would have called lack of mentality or whatever. You know, like, that was what that Sheffield United match really said to me.
You look at Everton today, and I understand where Ben's coming from, because I don't think there was a big thing we did differently. I'm a little reluctant to ascribe Everton was just bad to it, because we would never say the same thing about us if we just couldn't. But, I mean, other than Toby just maybe being a little bit better at sort of cleaning up messes in the box, there was a few headers in particular I'm thinking of, on crosses and whatnot, and maybe Spurs just being a little more fucking on their shit. Like, it's hard to point to something we did differently other than, you know, I don't know, we kept the ball well for the first half. Like, we didn't afford them a ton of chances at the beginning of the first half of the game. Like, other than, like, maybe sort of how we generally approach the game, it didn't strike me like there was a big thing we were doing differently. And other than, yeah, Toby's in there, and, you know, we seem to want to control it a little bit more than we did against Sheffield. I don't really know what to say. It's infuriating watching this team right now, because maybe these guys are declining all at the same time. I feel like we ought to be watching a better, I feel like just being on the pitch together, these guys should be able to put together better performances than we're seeing.
I mean, it's just weird to me that, and you know, I guess, look, you have to give them some credit that we changed managers mid-season or whatever, but there just still appears to be no sort of coherent plan. And, you know, I think Greg hit on this earlier, we've kind of looked this way since about January of last season, when things started to tail off under Pochettino, and we the show became progressively sadder and sadder. You know, like to me, there hasn't been, like, an appreciable difference between Mourinho ball and what we saw in latter era Pochettino. Like, I understand we turned the pressing down a little bit, but in terms of the quality and, you know, the patterns of play and stuff, it's not really that different, I don't feel like. I mean,
there was an uptick in solidity at first, and then it declined, and I think we ought to be fair to Mourinho in this case. I think a big reason for the decline was that team started to be a fucking walking mash unit. And I was actually willing, like, I was thinking, like, a lot of Spurs fans were being unnecessarily harsh on Mourinho coming out of the quarantine, because I thought, like, look, this team's performances really started to decline when, like, what remained of our midfield went out. Certainly when our, like, attack just completely fell apart because Kane got hurt. You know, everyone but, like, Moura was the only attacker who was healthy before we, you know, the COVID hit. And, you know, I thought there was something, too. Like, this is an injury crisis, and this is, like, severely limiting the way we play. Like, you know, the Red Bull game in particular, it was kind of like, I don't know what you fucking expect us to do with these attacking options. You know, even if you throw Troy Parrott out there, I don't know how good it's going to be. But, you know, since we've gotten back, like, I mean, even if you accept Bergwijn, Kane's a little tired, Bergwijn needs his minutes managed, you know, even if you, let's take it even further. Let's even assume for the sake of the argument that, like, Ndombele's a fuckface who doesn't know how to train. Like, let's assume he can't play these minutes. Like, we should still look better than we do. And it's, you know, like, I'm tired of the excuses. I'm tired of, like, I don't necessarily expect us to qualify for the Champions League right now, but I expect performances that are, even if they're not as, like, attacking or fluid, I expect them to be better than what we've seen. And it's just, you know, I don't, like, if, like, you know, like I said, maybe we'll look better after a summer. We get one or two players in. He's had a little bit more time to implement a coherent strategy. Maybe we'll look better. But, like, I, you know, he's running out of excuses and he's running out of time. And I understand he didn't come in the ideal circumstances, but this is painful to watch right now. And we were joking about this, I think, before the podcast. I don't know if we were actually recording when we were joking about this, but, like, fuck, I would have rather us bring in a guy like Setien and, like, you know, let's go with, like, some suicidal attacking options. At least that would be some fun shit to watch until we can hire a real manager in the summer. Like, damn. I mean, it couldn't be as bad as this. I mean, it could absolutely be as bad as this, but maybe it wouldn't have been. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the margins here are very fine. You know, if we had beaten Sheffield United, we'd be 4 points out of fifth, and we'd be saying, oh, you know what, like, it's been boring and bad, but at least it's working. You know, we had a unlucky penalty against Man U. We had a good win against West Ham. We grounded out for a couple games. Like, if that's what Jose is going to give you, then, you know, you can work with that. You know, you could say, well, it sucks to watch, but, you know, we were in a bad situation before. Maybe it's going to help, whatever. But again, it's like, the flip side of that is, had we lost today, we would have been in 11th behind Burnley and Everton. And it's just like, you know, right now, the margins of, like, how we feel about what's happening, I think, can swing very wildly.
Yes.
Things are very tight. But, you know, I think it's pretty undeniable that the last two games we've played have been much less than the sum of our parts. You know, for all the injury crisis that we've had and all the injuries we've dealt with and, you know, all the pieces we have to fit together, you know, we're not worse than Burnley. Even our third string team, man for man, is as good as, you know, fucking Ashley Westwood and, you know, the White Lives Matter crew at that fucking club. It's like, you know, these excuses will only get you so far when you look at the teams around us who are doing comparably. You know, I don't know that Setien or fucking Scott Parker would be a better bet than Jose Mourinho. But at the very least, if we're hiring somebody like that, at least you can envision that, like, this is building towards something. There's a plan here, and it's going to turn into something. And that's, I think, my biggest problem with what's happening under Jose Mourinho is I just don't feel like we're building towards anything. Every game is just kind of like a one-off experience that for 90 minutes I suffer through. Either we won or lost. I'm upset about it either way because it was shitty to watch. And then the next day happens, and we're right back to it.
Well,
and it doesn't feel like nothing that happened in the first two games seemed to develop into anything that happened in the next two games.
I think if you're
in the next five games, or the next season, or the next three seasons. So it's just like, what the fuck are we doing?
The only,
you know, Levy's whole term here. Sorry, I just want to
no. Finish, please. Sorry.
No, go, you know, by all means.
This man's been in charge for like 20 years, and there's been ups and downs and whatever. But I've always felt like, from manager to manager, from director of football to scouting director to Paul Mitchell's black box, it always felt like we were trying something to build this team into a newer and better version of itself. And this period of Spurs feels like such a sad defensive crouch of just, we don't know where we're going. All we know is we're bleeding heavily and we have to staunch the wounds before it gets too bad and kills us. And it's not even really doing that.
Well, and I feel
even
like,
even if we do, to what end?
That's the problem that we're in. Because I think Pochettino, we've talked about this on the show before, Pochettino getting fired in October put this team in a position where they had a bunch of bad decisions to make. And the problem is they picked someone who they thought could stop the bleeding. The problem is they picked someone who, whether or not he has done that or could do that or whatever, he was there with the express concern of, like, oh, a longer-term contract. And, you know, what sucks about having to hire a manager in October is, like, you want someone who's, like, it's hard to find someone who's, like, fuck it, let's just get through this year and we'll figure it out in the summer, which is what the situation, I would put a lot of money on, that's where Daniel Levy would have liked to have been. Maybe he still would have hired Mourinho, I don't know. But he would have liked to have been in a situation where it's, like, let's get through the fucking season and we'll do it in the summer. Now, my suspicion is, player retention was a big issue of that. Maybe he still has a boner for Mourinho going back to, you know, when he fired Yole. But I think there's an element of when Pochettino got fired when he did, we had just had to make bad decisions, and we've been compounding that for a while. Now, you can make the argument Mourinho probably helped us do a better job of making sure that Dele Alli and Harry Kane were ready to put in transfer requests the second the season ended. But, like, I just don't think we're in a better situation now than if we just gotten fucking, I don't know, David Pleat out of retirement and been like, just get us through the season, and in April we can announce we've hired, like, fucking Leipzig's head coach or whatever.
Well, I think the thing is it, and, you know, look, I guess I'm as close as we're going to get on the show to a Jose Mourinho proponent. But I think Ben is right. I think the decision-making in terms of the appointment of Jose Mourinho speaks more to short-termism. And the reason you hire Jose Mourinho with a particular group of players is that you believe that that particular group of players is on the cusp or is right there in terms of being able to win something. And so, you know, I think if you're not looking at the whole picture, you look at, oh, we were in a Champions League final last year and we were that close to winning a Champions League. Then the hiring of Jose Mourinho makes sense. But if you look at the bigger picture of where Spurs were in terms of you haven't refreshed the squad really in 3 years, you haven't done, you haven't brought through any meaningful young players in years, you know, then the short-termism in hiring Jose Mourinho makes zero sense. And then also the weirdness of giving him a 3.5-year contract while also, you know, pushing this kind of short-termist agenda where we can win something in, you know, a relatively short period of time doesn't make sense. And so, yeah, maybe it made more sense to hire either someone that was an interim to make it through to the summer or to hire somebody who was, you know, more like a Pochettino in that they were an ambitious, like, sort of program builder, to use a college football phrasing, but like something like that. Whereas if you hire Jose Mourinho, you hire there's not a lot of other good examples that aren't elite coaches at elite
you're expecting club, immediate like, results.
Yeah, if you're hiring Jose Mourinho, Louis van Gaal, you're expecting like this is a specific set of players that are going to get a specific set of results for me, and I don't think we had that, and so I think that's a little bit of a blind spot from Levy.
I think that's actually really astute, and the first time I've really heard it put that way. And I think it's both damning and defensible kind of in the same breath, where Levy looked at that Champions League final squad and said, this is where we are. This is the ability of what this team is right now. We just need to get the guy to put the trophy in the cabinet, and that's where we are. And if that's the mindset, that's really the only thing I can think of that makes hiring Jose makes sense.
Well, think about it.
At the same time, like, that calculus, in the wake of Pochettino's departure, and the season we had leading up to the Champions League final, to think that we are a Champions League finalist caliber club right now with the squad we have right now, I think is also insane.
I think
we clearly had so many holes and so many problems.
I think it's more insane. I think it's more insane in hindsight. Because I know I would have said that
this summer I would have agreed with you after October when Boston was gone.
So we're on the same page, because I can see Levy thinking, you know what, this team was really good, they could play to their potential. The big issue is there's a giant gaping hole in midfield. I've given you two of the best young midfielders in Europe that'll fill it. Like, this is a team that's ready to fucking go. And yeah, by October I think you could see the cracks in the wall. But like, I don't know, maybe he still thought like, Lo Celso's barely played, and Ndombele's been hurt. You know, once you get these guys right, it's really going to turn things around. I don't fucking know. It's like, but I think Brian's right. He clearly expected immediate results, and, like, you know, I think there was a lack of choices to be made there. Especially, I think it was ITK that went around that Carlo bombed his interview with us, which I don't know if it's true, but it sounds like a thing that could be true. You know, there weren't a lot of managers that we could have hired at that point in time. I don't think there's a lot of managers we could have pulled away. It sounds like, I know there's been rumors we tried to get Brendan Rodgers out of Leicester, which I think might have been a disaster on the level of Mourinho. And I'm kind of glad that didn't happen. But, you know, I think this Mourinho mess is going to have to sort of, like, look, let's talk about this. This will be the last thing I think we should talk about. And I want to start with Brian, because I think Ben will have a more flip answer. But Brian, what do you think, putting aside extraordinary events, What do you think it would take for Jose Mourinho to get fired at Spurs? Not at, like, eventually. It doesn't have to be by the end of the season, because it would take an extraordinary event by the end of the season.
I mean, look, it's the same thing that we saw with the end of Pochettino. I mean, look, Levy is committed to 3.5 years of Jose Mourinho, and I don't think that there's really a world in which Jose doesn't get at least next season to kind of do what he wants with this team. You know, especially because we're talking about, like, this weird world that we're in where we don't know what the summer transfer window will look like. We don't know what the markets will be. You know, we don't even know, like, you know, the Champions League is all happening in August, and then it starts again in September.
No one's pulling in revenues either, so.
Yeah, so look, it's going to be weird. And so I think because of that, Jose gets at least another year, which is a little depressing to think about. But like, yeah, to have it end, like, in the next season, the 2020-2021 season, I mean, open player revolt. I don't think, unless the results are so bad that we're, like, 15th.
So you think we're, lower, like, 8th in the table, playing, like, this kind of level of performance by Christmas? Do you think he survives the holiday period?
I don't know. I
and not like eighth of the table where you're like 3 points off top four. Like eighth of the table where you're like 7 to 10 points off the top four. Like
I know that I should have like a take here one way or the other, but it's just like it's such a like a
hard, yeah. Address the issue, Brian. Come on.
Yeah. It's just like it's. But it's because, like, Levy has tied up so much money in this. And, you know, a 3.5-year deal to Jose Mourinho, you're almost committed to at least giving him a lot, you know, a significant portion of this deal.
Yeah, barring some shit happening. Yeah, that's
if we're eighth, we're not in the Europa League, we're out of the League Cup, we're, you know, I don't know. Then, yeah, maybe, I don't know. How bad are we losing matches? Are we losing matches 1-0? Are we losing matches 6-0? Like, you know,
is there a crowd there to boo him every week? Like, you know.
Yeah, I really don't know. I think it takes something extreme for Levy to bounce Mourinho next season. I think if at the end of next season we look at things and we look at the landscape of where other teams are in the Premier League, and we make a decision then. But I mean, I think the thing that Levy is going to actually use as a measuring stick is what are the teams around us doing? Like, Spurs have done so much in the last 3 or 4 years to overhaul some of, like Arsenal and Manchester United and some of the clubs around us. But are we now going to get overhauled by Wolves and Leicester? And, you know, is Arsenal going to come back and start, you know, performing significantly better than us? Like that's going to be the measuring stick that Levy uses. And if so, that to me is the thing that might get Mourinho bounced at the end of the season.
Ben, what do you think could get him fired?
So I think Brian's right. It's purely a financial calculus at this point. We are pot committed to Jose right now for £45 million. Yeah, he's got $15 million a year for 3.5 years. So if we sack him early, we have to pay him the remainder of his contract. You know, the ability to sack Pochettino, I think it came at a £20 million cost. And to get there, we basically had to have a full-on player revolt, it sounded like, before that became what was the unavoidable consequence of what was happening at this club. And so now with Jose, we have more than double the financial commitment to his departure. That's how you have to calculate it. I mean, that's not how you should calculate it if you care about running a football team, but that's how Daniel Levy's going to calculate it, because that's how Daniel Levy calculates everything, at what point is it cheaper to fire Jose than it is to keep him? And that's going to come to, yeah, are we in 8th, 10th place, and we're losing another year of Champions League revenues? Is there a point where that Champions League revenue becomes salvageable? Is there a point where he's embarrassed himself so publicly, like, made a dumb All Lives Matter comment that you can kind of shuffle him out the door on the cheap?
Yeah. Does Harry Kane walk into his office and say, it's Jose or me? Like,
right, exactly. Like, are you going to, you know, we're already looking at taking a bath on Tanguy Ndombele, who's, you know, our record signing. You know, if we're looking at selling him for £30 million and we spent 65 on him. Well, shit, that 35 is pretty close to the severance package we're going to have to pay Jose. How do those numbers sync up? And I think, again, and that's the only calculus I think is going to matter to Daniel Levy is who are we going to lose? How much is it going to cost to lose us? What are we going to lose on in broadcast rights based on our table finish? What are we going to lose in European competition pot money? Those are the numbers he's going to be weighing up.
And also, I think
until it comes to something like that, if he muddles along and playing boring football and alienating players, but he has us in the top four next year, he's not going anywhere.
Here's the thing, but no, that's the thing about Mourinho, and that's where we aren't, where we are not with Mourinho, which is Mourinho is always he's been an asshole. He alienates players. He doesn't play entertaining football a lot of the time. But until like. I don't know, United went off the rails in his second season, he could always back his shit up, because what does he do? He wins. He wins trophies everywhere he goes. He, you know, even at United, which was a fucking disaster, he won, like, two trophies in his first year, which I know by their standards wasn't, like, great, but we'd be, you know, if Tottenham had a season where we won a European trophy and the fucking FA Cup, we'd be over the fucking moon. Well,
I think according to Jose, he won a treble, because they won the Community Shield that year, I believe.
But see, that's the kind of shit Mourinho would do that you put up with, that clubs would put up with because he was winning things. And if he's not doing that at Tottenham, if we're playing shitty football, and he's alienating record signings, and we're fucking in eighth place and not even close to top four, then what's the fucking point? Because the only point of having Mourinho at your club is he wins things. Like, that's why you have Jose Mourinho at your club. Like, he's a winner. And, I don't know if football's passed him by or his style of management. I think it's his style of management. It's just not aged well. But, you know, it's just... It clearly ain't working like it used to. Now, you know, I think the question is also, is there going to be a replacement lined up that Daniel Levy wants to pull the trigger on? And I think Mourinho's a big enough name where we're not going to see that. But, you know, I don't know. I think Brian's probably right. I think maybe at the end of next year he looks at everything and is like, you know what, fuck you, you're out of here. But I think it would – Ben made a good point. I think it's going to take a lot for that to happen before then, which I don't think is likely, but it's certainly not impossible given – who we're talking about and what we saw happen under Mauricio Pochettino. Because, you know, I think, you know, if Harry Kane walks into Levy's office and puts an ultimatum, I think Levy will sign with, I think Levy will sign with Kane over Mourinho every day of the week. And, you know, it's just
unfortunate because the guys you're concerned about losing, like Harry Kane and Dele Alli, are probably guys you should have cashed in on.
Yeah, but probably. Maybe they can contribute one last thing to the club then. It just sucks. And it's, you know, I think I was willing to give Mourinho a lot more of a shot than a lot of Spurs fans because I didn't live through his first spell at Chelsea. I was not a Spurs fan when that happened. So I don't have nearly as much animosity as, say, our friend Vince does for him, which I think is largely born out of that period of time. You know, obviously I know Mourinho's rep and I've seen him abroad and at United and, you know, I mean, my concerns with him are much more about how's he going to manage the squad, how's he going to deal with Tottenham's transfer budget, and you know, those he doesn't seem to be doing either very well right now, and it's just, I don't think it's going to work out, but I think we're going to have to play out the string, and it's going to suck to watch it happen.
It's funny you say that because you know I was there for that, and it really isn't a matter of personal animosity for me when it comes to Jose Mourinho. Like he's a piece of shit, but in that era of Chelsea, like. He was a compelling piece of shit. Like, he was just a perfect heel, a wonderful villain, and just an undeniably excellent manager. After, you know, the Porto Champions League and then what he did at Chelsea was just undeniably great. And honestly, you could take that through his time at Chelsea to Inter, to even his first couple of years at Real Madrid. Like, if you had told me in 2013 Jose Mourinho was on the table, I would have been like, yeah, this guy's a dickhead. But... he's a guy who we should be fucking absolutely trying to get. You know, it's really the kind of post-Real Madrid or kind of end of Real Madrid in his second tenure at Chelsea where he even managed to win another title and his time at Man U where you can kind of like put together the pieces of those last three club experiences and see how toxic the environment was and how alienating he was towards the players and, you know, how much of the returns had diminished since his heyday and how far behind the landscape of modern football he'd grown. I mean, that's really, to me, like, why I don't want Jose Mourinho. The fact that he's a dickhead on top of that is just like...
I just think I think even any of us together.
If you win and you're a dickhead, fine. Yeah. You are a dickhead. Everyone likes a good dickhead.
I think even Mourinho at his prime, like, I mean, my first concern when I heard we were linked with Mourinho in a serious way, my first concern, because I was willing to take for the sake of argument, like, United was just a bad situation, right? My big concern with Mourinho is, like, this guy has, when's the last time he had to, like, get creative with squad building? Which isn't to say that he didn't do smart things at, say, Chelsea or Madrid or whatever, because he did. I think some of the things he did with his personnel at Chelsea were, the second time around, were, you know, I think he was still a talented manager at that point. And, you know, he might still be a talented manager today, but, like, he hasn't been at a club where he couldn't buy anyone he wanted, for the most part.
I think since he was really Inter. That's the only time in his CV that you can look at and be like, wow, this is, like, actually inventive use of squad
I'm
management.
Sure Porto. I wasn't around for Porto. I'm sure if you look at that Porto squad. Like,
I mean, that Porto squad just happened to be very stacked with guys like Carvalho and Deco and who went on to play very, like, celebrated careers at major clubs. You know, like, obviously, they weren't all that. You know, he did do some good work, but I think it was, like, a coherent squad that he built and molded, whatever. Inter was really a team where he's, like, making Samuel Eto'o and Goran Pandev play, like, wide defensive forwards, and made Wesley Sneijder the best midfielder in the world for a year, you know? Like, he did actual work with that team that I think is impressive and is the kind of thing that you'd like to see him look at this squad and say, okay, how can I mold this into my Jose Mourinho-esque team but make it work and make guys who, like, again, getting Samuel Eto'o, a guy who is not a guy that you would expect to subsume his own ego into the good of the team.
No, a guy who got kicked off the best team in the world.
Exactly.
For that reason.
Exactly. You know, like, that's an amazing accomplishment, frankly. You know, I would take that if, you know, he turned Heung-min Son into that. It would suck to watch, but if, like, it won games and it was good, it'd be like, you know, he sucks. I hate watching this, but, like, it's undeniable he is managing this group of players into a cohesive vision of what he wants a team to be. And there's just none of that.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel like he's got it in him to sort of be creative enough to turn Tottenham with our resource level into a successful team. And it's just, you know, I don't know. Like, we're also coming off the sting of, you know, I think we all thought Pochettino was going to be here for, like, over a decade. Like, you know, we thought that guy was going to be here forever. And it's just, look, we're going to talk about this more. I don't think there's any. I think he's here for a while, barring something crazy happening, which, again, is, I don't think likely, but certainly not impossible. But, you know, we're just going to have to deal with it. And we got Bournemouth and Arsenal coming up, and I think we're, you know, I hope I'm wrong. I think we're all going to be very big mad after the Arsenal match, but even if I'm not nearly as impressed with Arteta as some other people are. But on that note, we've been going on for quite a while tonight about two very awful games, you guys. Brian, do you have any thoughts for the people?
I guess the only thing I wanted to add is that I didn't think that the Lloris and Son thing was that big a deal.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I feel like you see that shit in every sport. You know, captain of the team didn't think some guy put in the effort he should, and he should have saved it for the locker room, but he didn't. For all of Mourinho's sins, I wouldn't, like, I don't think that is something that to get worked up about. Ben, I know you have a harsher view of this team than we do, but.
Yeah, no, I don't care. That happened on the pitch. It was between them. It seemed to get over it. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, it might mean something, but I'm not willing to declare that it means something until it means something.
I feel like it is common enough in virtually every professional sport that I watch that it doesn't really bother me.
Yeah, I mean, I saw takes floating around on Twitter that, like, you know, this was indicative of what Jose Mourinho is fostering at the club. And to me, it's just like, look, you've got competitive people, you know,
in a shitty season.
Yeah, you've got a situation where one player who happens to be the captain thinks that another player should have done a better job. And, like, yeah, should he have said it in the locker room? Probably. But you know what? He didn't.
Now, I will say, it's entirely possible it does mean something. It might mean something bigger at the club. It might mean that, like, yeah, everybody's pissed off and having a shitty time, and, like, you know, they're letting their emotions get the best of them on the pitch because, you know, they don't want to lose another game like this Sheffield game because shit's going badly. It, you know, again, it might mean something, but I think it probably doesn't. So fucking don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Until next week when, you know, son cold cocks Hugo Lloris and gets a red card for beating up his own teammate.
Hey, that'll be something to talk about at least.
Yeah, that's one thing we're certainly lacking is things to talk about right now.
Brian, where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Brian_Ashlock. That's Brian with a Y.
Ben, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at ComradeUSpurs.
And you can find me on Twitter at Skipjack0079. And, of course, don't forget to follow us all on LinkedIn at Brett Rainbow. Now, for Ben, for Brian, and, of course, for Brett Rainbow, I have been your host, Greg. Come on, you Spurs.